Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Empower You Radio Network, and thank you for joining us today on Living Astrology, where we are tapping into the magic of the cosmos for practical guidance and wisdom, with your host, Janet Hickox, intuitive astrologer and numerologist. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Living Astrology. My name is Janet Hickox, and I am your host today. And I'm going to introduce you right off to my friend, Bryn Morgan. Bryn is a psychic, writer, and astrologer specializing in personal and planetary actualization. Intuitive empath and Akashic record keeper since birth, she has developed and honed cutting-edge tools for personal and planetary integration in both metaphysical and business environments. She now focuses on working with others and supporting the Awakened Oracle Metaphysical Institute, a center for new thought, and the Human Potential Movement. Please welcome Bryn Morgan. Hello, Bryn.
Hi, Janet. Thank you so much for having me on again. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, as always, I am very excited to have you on the show and to be able to talk about some of the subjects that we're going to be working with today. Today's show is, of course, New Paradigms in Astrology, which, Bryn, I dare say you're a researcher into these topics, correct? I mean, is that a good characterization?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because, you know...
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I mean, for me, it's all about creating new paradigms and the fact that we all know that the old paradigms are going away, but that's one of the reasons how I participate with personal actualization and planetary actualization is just pushing into trying to hypothesize and then vet and create new paradigms in any field that, that holds my soul's interest. And astrology is one of those.
Woohoo! It's one of mine, too. We have that in common. How nice is that?
Yep.
A lot of what we're going to be talking about today is important, as there have been some huge changes in terms of what we know about our universe or our solar system, and it's the advent of new planets, new classifications of planets, and some of the things that we're exploring in the outer universe that have really created the opening for us to be talking about this. So Bryn and I will be getting into we're going to try to get through six of the main topics, probably not get to too much depth on all of them, but we want to explore some of the things that Bryn is looking at in terms of changes in our knowledge of the universe and how that affects us from the astrology side of things. But before we get to there, I would like to talk a little bit about some of the things that are going on in the sky. As always, what's up in the sky is just as important to me, the astronomical view, as much as the astrological view. But I'm going to start with what I feel like is the best news ever, and that is today Mercury goes direct. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, it went direct 27 minutes ago or so. Yay, hallelujah. Mercury's been in retrograde since, May 4th was the beginning of the shadow. May 18th, it turned retrograde, and I think this has been one of the worst retrograde periods I've ever experienced. Maybe because I'm more aware of it as an astrologer, I don't know. Maybe because it was in my natal sign of Gemini, who knows? But everybody's been telling me, when is Mercury going back to direct? Bryn, this has been pretty bad for you too, right? Or pretty difficult for all of us?
It has. It's just been a very hard spring. Really, everything started with that massive spring equinox and then the eclipse. And by gum, has it been a difficult ride since then.
I agree. To me, I mean, as astrologers, of course, we also, get a peek at other people's lives and what's going on for them. But even personally this time, it has been difficult, from computer challenges to physical, health challenges to just family dynamic type things. It's been very interesting. So that is Mercury, even though it's gone direct today, will still be in the shadow until about June 26th. Then at that point, it will start out in a new degree of Gemini that it hasn't been in yet. So we can say goodbye to that particular, that whole retrograde cycle, and not be bothered by it again until September, I guess it is. Along with Mercury turning direct, we have some other interesting things going on this week. On the 12th, which is tomorrow, we have Neptune turning retrograde. And I really like it when Neptune turns retrograde. And what I often will advise people when it does is to be very aware of your intuition and be very careful that you pay attention and act from that space. As in, you know, 4 to 5 months from now when it turns back to direct, you may find that some of the inner urgings that you had during the retrograde, if you didn't act upon them, you may be regretting that decision. So stay tuned to your intuition. I also find it interesting, and I don't know if you know anything about this one, Bryn, but, you know, in regular astrology, sometimes we look at Neptune as a sort of higher octave of Mercury, or the spiritual side of Mercury, as in it's partly the spiritual, where Mercury rules the mind. It's more physical, the other one more spiritual. So it's interesting that both of those change direction within a day of each other. As we get into the later in the week, the 14th, the Sun conjuncts Mars. That's a very energetic time when that happens. Happens once a year as the Sun moves around and meets up with Mars. So just be aware of how you're, you know, behaving out in the world. Of course, the Sun, Mars, and Mercury had been very close to each other in Gemini over the last couple of weeks. And they're separating from Mercury at this point in time. Saturn in retrograde motion is now backing into Scorpio, and on the 15th it'll move into Scorpio. That takes us back to what was going on for the last couple of years as Saturn was transiting Scorpio. So we may have a little more work to do, letting go or connecting with emotions or taking a deeper look at some of the issues of our lives. I don't know if I'm excited about that or filled with a little bit of trepidation. There may be some things that you all were working on that maybe, you know, issues and things that you thought were done with but may come back to need some more work. Just be aware. And then, of course, next week also on the 16th, the new moon in Gemini, bringing us new ways of thinking perhaps, new ways of being able to communicate. And let's see, what else did I read? Oh, Ceres, which is another, is one of the dwarf planets now that Pluto's been demoted. She was sort of promoted. And Bryn, you'll be talking to us a little bit about her, I would bet. But she's also in the news today. And there's actually a contest. I thought this was kind of funny, a contest where people can vote on what they think the bright spots that scientists are seeing in photos of Ceres, what they are. And, of course, things range from the funny, you know, alien bases to the last one I heard was something like salt deposits or crystalline deposits or something like that. Have you heard that, Bryn?
Yes. I hadn't heard about the contest, but I did know about the spot and that there's a probe that's very that'll be landing on that, on Ceres. So I think that's why they're going to be able to determine what the spot is, hence the contest prior to that.
Yeah, it's like vote for your favorite thing. I'm not sure that aliens are one of them, but I just thought that was funny because you know that's going to come up. It's an alien base.
Yeah.
It's going to come up, no doubt. And last but not least, which leads us actually quite nicely into the subject of our talk today, is this comes from regular science people talking about the constellation of Fucus, and I'm not even sure I'm saying that right. How do you say it, Bryn?
You know what? I haven't gotten that pronunciation down either. So
yeah, me neither.
I like
I've
your pronunciation.
Yeah, we'll just call it Ophiuchus until someone tells us something else.
Yeah.
But beginning this month, you can actually connect visually with the constellation of Fucus in the night sky. And if you're in the mid-latitudes of North America, which we're just a little bit above mid-latitude, but you can look south after the sun sets, actually after it's dark for us here in the Pacific Northwest. That means after 10 o'clock or so at night. And you can look for the bright red star Antares, which is the is in the constellation Scorpio. And if you're looking up at the sky and you see the red star Antares, look to the left of that and you will connect with the constellation Ophiuchus, or at least the foot of Ophiuchus, which is really interesting. So the Ophiuchus is joined in legend, by the way, and in the sky to the constellation of the serpent called Serpens. This is one of the constellations that looks like it's supposed to, right? It really looks like a guy, a man, holding a snake. So Ophiuchus is the is a healer, and it is identified with Asclepius, which is said to have been the first doctor, who was said to have been the first doctor, and he learned his trade supposedly from a snake. And it's the same tradition, of course, that causes us to see the snake intertwined with a staff in doctor's offices and hospitals and so forth. And it's said that Asclepius was such a powerful healer that he succeeded in raising the dead. And by the way, Asclepius is just another name for Ophiuchus. And in raising the dead, he angered Pluto, the god of the underworld. And so to make peace amongst the gods, Zeus transported Asclepius or Ophiuchus to the night sky. So here's the interesting line that I wrote this down because I thought it was really interesting. She calls it the Ophiuchus is the constellation that astrologers forgot. The sun lies within its boundaries for a few weeks each year, from November 30th to December 18th. And many people are born between these dates, but of course, yet no one is ever claiming to be an Ophiuchus. And that's a quote from Earth and Sky. And, you know, of course, this is not new. This is not a new piece of information for me, and I know it's not necessarily new for you, and I know that it is one of the areas that you, or areas that you've been looking into as far as the shift in the location of constellations since, you know, the zodiac was originally defined. So, but before we get into some of the details of the astrology paradigms that are changing, give us sort of a general outlook and why should we be interested in this and what is its meaning for us?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, those are great questions, Janet. I mean, my passion about this, as you know from knowing me all these years, this is not a passion that's bringing me forward to tell people how it all is. It's the passion to question. And I think that's where it all starts for me. The idea that we absolutely are going through a shift. There's no question that old paradigms are no longer fitting, feeling comfortable, addressing our experience, working. And that's across the board in my experience, everything from banking and business to many of the classic and beautiful esoteric tools that we have relied upon and developed and brought with us over many thousands of years. And with astrology, my passion for astrology, I started as an astrologer in the early 90s, and I recognized that language intuitively almost immediately. And since that date, I've done far more intuitive development of my astrological practice than I have studied astrology. But in bringing them together, of course, we have a great body of wisdom about astrology that we rely on and commonly refer to. However, it was developed largely in Babylonia, right? And frankly, it's around Athens, and I think it's like one of the first references to anybody really doing a natal chart or applying it in a natal chart to a person. Apparently, is a reference to Socrates, and that an astrologer, Chilean, who had predicted his death. So, but up until really, well, anybody practicing astrology, and of course, astrology being the foundation for astronomy. So our study of mathematics and the stars was all tied back to some version or concept that you and I might tie to astrology. While they clearly emphasized the eclipses, certain things that we may not stare at as often as astrologers, in the history, they were very focused on the equinoxes, the eclipses, the progression of the equinoxes, etc., because this appears to have been a body of knowledge designed to predict human events. It was it was very much a deterministic science. And so this was perceived from a scientific viewpoint, that these external shifts and you know, the dance of the spheres above us were not just opening doors for optimum use of our energy as we might discuss it today. They were perceiving that as deterministic. This is going to control our behavior. So until really astrology loses, you know, astrology really, I would imagine, I'm not a historian, and I'm sure there's phenomenal astrologers who out there who are historians, but it, you know, my basic understanding is that astrology loses favor somewhere, you know, in the early part of the 1700s. But I did mention, and it is interesting, that Isaac Newton actually said that his passion for mathematics and his came from an astrology book. He opened an astrology book and saw the charts and was so mesmerized as a young man, apparently a fairly young man, and really wanted to learn how to calculate that. So he began to study the sciences to study that. It becomes very clear that he in no way values astrology very much. I mean, it's not like he is an astrologer. He doesn't value it, although he did go on to have his great passion for not only the biblical studies but alchemy. So, you know, it wasn't that he left what you and I might consider esoteric or theosophy at all. He did not, in fact, value astrology. I think it has remained, you know, so when astrology really appears to come back to the forefront, it's at the very end of the 1800s and the early 1900s as Theosophy and Rosicrucians and everybody sort of bringing back all of this great esoteric wisdom, and it's of great interest once again. And so astrology sort of comes back to light, and very quickly, I would say, into that, you know, within 40 or, you know, 30 or about in the same time, you know, around the same time we cite Pluto, for instance, in 1930, we're also moving into the idea of humanistic astrology. People are beginning to entertain the idea from a psychological standpoint, from Freudian, from Jung, that we're moving quickly into the idea that we have choices around our behavior, and you know, external factors completely determining our fate really stops being the human viewpoint of life. And so it is with astrology. So what we're practicing today, I would say, is still humanistic astrology, and in that way only harkens back to a certain extent to these roots from 2,000-3,000 years ago. Collectively in general, one of the hallmarks is that, of course, new planets were sighted. So inside of this body of knowledge that was the deterministic stuff was only the planets and places that could be seen really basically with the naked eye. So we were working with the planets out as far as Saturn and the moon and the sun. And that was it. That's as much as we could see, and all of astrology was being described inside of those planets. So as our ability to see further into the universe developed, we saw, oh, wait a minute, there's Uranus. Oh, well, hell, there's Neptune. And, you know, of course, those two being sighted in the late 1700s and then the mid-1800s, my understanding is that there's really not a lot of practicing astrologers out there integrating that into their work. But by the time we come up, and I wasn't there, but I have a suspicion that by the time astrology is back in the forefront and being sought out as an esoteric body of knowledge, and then all of a sudden Pluto, the ninth quote-unquote planet, is sighted, I think this really came together and people began to look for meaning and to start to read all of these new planets in the chart. So it's really, in my understanding of this is that it starts largely with Pluto, and we live with this idea that if we as humans are able, because obviously the solar system isn't changing, what's happening is our understanding of the solar system is changing. So
right,
as new planets, yes, as new planets are sighted, there is, my understanding of this work suggests that some new, whatever the part of our psyche, consciousness, whatever, that this planet represents is now becoming active in our consciousness. So it was there and it was latent, but now it's becoming active. And that was absolutely the process that we've used for certainly as people, we would rely usually on, here's a new planet, here's Pluto. They'd start out studying the mythology of the name, of course, and then look specifically for events triggered by Pluto, sensitivity to that planet, right? We all work with it in our clients' charts, and we work with it as in external events to see if we can bring together and flush out a body of knowledge about what this symbolically represents or what it represents in our chart. And what it represents in general. So events triggered by transits, conjunctions, et cetera, are coloring that landscape for us. So as a result, here we sit. This understanding we have of our own solar system, not the universe, but our solar system, has changed really dramatically in just 10 years. And I believe that, therefore, astrology, these are topics, a variety of topics that we were going to discuss today are just topics that I don't think it's the inclusive list. This is just the starting places where I've said, these are significant changes. How are we dealing with this as astrologers? Because we have to live with our own tenet. If it changes our understanding changes of the solar system, something new is sighted, something changes, it represents a change in our consciousness around whatever that represents. And we should or could integrate that as astrologers. So
yeah, now you see, that's the part that I find fascinating, is that there's so much coming at us that's new, and the potential for new connections is really high as we get, new planets or dwarf planets, or our knowledge expands around the ones that are out there, that we've already known about, for example, Ceres and Pluto. And I want to get to Pluto really quickly, unless you have another point you want to make, because there's something really fascinating about Pluto that I want you to be able to share with people.
Absolutely.
Did you have another point?
No, I mean that's it. It's just that that's it, and we can move right into some of those changes. But you said something really important, and consciousness is changing very rapidly, and it makes a great deal. In fact, it even supports my hypothesis in my mind to realize that the changes that we're aware of in the solar system are now happening so rapidly, astrologers are having trouble, I think, keeping up. I don't think these topics are discussed very often, because I don't think we haven't even begun to integrate all of the changes that are coming at us, just like it is most places in all of our lives. So astrology is just mirroring, right? This is not unique to astrology. That's how it is in consciousness right now. And of all the things I believe about what's happening, and I'll jump right on Pluto, at the core of it, I think it represents in some ways the reemergence of the feminine principle. And what I mean by that is one of the great embodiments of the feminine is the chaos that balances structure. And also the need to see this subjectively. We've been living in a world where astrologers, we treat things objectively quite often. I think we've been leery to practice. I feel that we are often too leery to practice this as an intuitive art. It doesn't always have to mean the same thing every day. It doesn't always have to mean the same thing in everybody's chart. That there is an intuitive, subjective reality that we can offer a client or view our external events is poo-pooed as we sort of kind of still, astrology being one of the very only esoteric science I know of, still kind of trying to hang its, you know, hang its hat on science. As if it is a purely objective science, and I'm not sure that it is. That doesn't
invalidate
it. To me, it invalidates.
Yeah, it does. I think it validates it more that it can be based on the interpretation of from our intuition, and I think that's a part of us that has been sort of relegated to the closet. And I think the further we go here in time and in our evolution as human beings, it's how we start to connect our disparate parts, right? Bringing spirit or our more spiritual side in with our more physical side, because you see that's really what happened in the world, you know, at large anyway, is that you know, before the Industrial Revolution, or let's say even before the 1400s, you know, people lived very much a spiritual life, in that there wasn't a whole lot of difference between it was more holistic, I guess that's the word I'm looking for. And then suddenly we get to this big scientific boom that happens in the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, and now we see this separation really begin to take place. And to me, I think what a lot of astrologers have tried to do is maintain a sort of mechanistic view of the universe instead of leaning more into the intuitive view that we can take when we look at someone's chart and how a planet might be working in their life versus, say, yours or mine. Does that make sense?
It's true. Oh, absolutely. And who can blame? I mean, part of that is our collective, right? I mean, I was in the same boat. I mean, I have, you know, because I didn't want to be completely invalidated and relegated to insanity by saying that this is a powerful intuitive tool, both in my life and in others, no matter how many times I sat in front of somebody and read the chart from the soul level to the best of my ability and watched that person's life significantly change. You know, you and I have had that experience more than once, and positively change, and not just for the moment, not just while they're sitting there, but have that person go away and continue to cite that information, which is just the information of who they are, presented outside of the traditional paradigm that society was viewing that person through. And I wasn't pulling it out of thin air. I was relying on a consistent experience I have of this astrology, even though I don't know I don't know that there is a scientific basis for it. I don't know why it works, but I do know that it works, and it's worked for 25 years, even when I wasn't, you know. Then that's the power of it. I keep putting this down, or you know, it's not always active in my life, and I pick it back up, and it's just as powerful, and it's still just as accurate. Something's here. And that's enough. It works as enough to prove that it has value. But anyway, so that's been my experience of us. To me, that's part of us. When I think of the feminine reemerging into balance with the masculine, I don't mean dominating the masculine. I mean, as it comes up and balances, I think valuing the intuitive, the knowing, that is beyond us, and realizing that chaos is a natural process that we go through to find new structures. That's what regeneration is. So embracing the chaos of not knowing for a while.
Yeah. So let's get into
Pluto. I'm sorry, I have to get down off my soapbox.
Yeah, get off your soapbox. It's good. You know, or let's both stay on our soapbox, right? Because, you know, we need to make this loud. And have people, you know, actually hear this and kind of connect with this material. So take us through Pluto, because that's fascinating. You and I did a whole show on Pluto, so we don't have to spend too much time on that. But, you know, there may be people listening now that didn't hear that show with us. And so talk about Pluto and some of the exciting things going on in there.
Okay, so Pluto and, you know, that bleeds over into the idea of dwarf planets. But Pluto in 2006, as we know, was declassified. It was no longer classified as a planet, and it was now classified as a dwarf planet. So what happened was the International Astronomy Association Union, whomever they are, they had to come up with a new category for a number of objects they saw orbiting the sun, and there were three criteria they determined were needed for to qualify as a planet. The one is you have to have you have to be round, so you have to have enough mass to be round. Obviously, you have to be orbiting the sun. And you have to have cleared your neighborhood. In other words, your mass has to be enough, have produce enough gravitational pull to, in fact, pull everything out of your neighborhood. So, in other words, it was going to disqualify anything that was in the asteroid belt, right? They haven't cleared the neighborhood. So Pluto didn't make the third criteria. It was not enough mass or whatever to clear its neighborhood. It doesn't mean it didn't have satellites, but it didn't make the third criteria. And so it was now qualified as a dwarf planet. And at the same time as them coming up with that conclusion, they then realized things that we had or classified as asteroids, Ceres being one, were now did qualify as dwarf planets. So they sort of recategorized a lot of objects we already knew about based on these new criteria. So so there's this interesting first change. We have demoted Pluto. What does that mean in our consciousness? But the thing that's, I think, stunning about that is not just that it's a dwarf planet, but at the same, prior to this, we knew Pluto had a very large moon, Charon. And Charon is the, mythologically, is the ferryman to the underworld. And Pluto, at this time, we're perceiving as representing sort of the death and rebirth and the core and the underworld and the higher octave of Mars. And so this is the ferryman. Well, at the time that they came up with these definitions, it is now recognized, although it's not officially stated, but this is being stated loosely on astronomical websites. This is not an astrological view. Charon, the moon, also basically qualifies as a dwarf planet. And in fact, Pluto and its moon, its very large moon, orbit each other, and their center of gravity is not inside either planet. So they are, by all standards, a binary planetary system.
And so the only one in our solar system that we know of, right?
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely
none
right.
Of the, even Earth and her moon are not considered a binary system because Earth has cleared her. She's not a dwarf planet, for
sure. More importantly, I mean, as we know, with gravitational pull, it's the total of the mass between the two objects, and they pull on each other. However, our moon is very small compared to us, which is why we get tiny undulations, which we recognize as the tides, right? The tides are because the actual physical Earth is being pulled, and the water is being pulled back and forth by the gravitational pull of the moon. So we recognize that the moon is affecting us, but it's fairly benign effect in the scheme of the movement of the sun, of the Earth. That is not true with Pluto. Pluto is being so affected, the mass of its moon is so large, that Pluto actually, there was a great image, and I don't know how to create the image, but while Pluto is going around the sun, Pluto is doing a tiny little inner orbit. In other words, the moon is pulling Pluto far enough that Pluto is actually, and the moon, its moon, are orbiting each other as they go around. And therefore, the center of gravity between these two bodies pulling on each other is not inside either one of those planets. Therefore, Pluto is actually being pulled into a tiny circular orbit as it goes, its own little orbit as it goes around the sun. There are, anybody who's interested in listening can Google Pluto, hyphen CHARON, and click images on Google, and you'll see what we're talking about. I'm probably not describing it well. But
yeah.
They are a binary system, which means they're basically two planets orbiting each other.
Wow.
So that should, the two of those right there, based on the tenets we've been using for astrology, should and do need to cause us as astrologers to revisit Pluto significantly. First of all, it's some sort of relationship planet. I don't know how we could avoid that. But I would, and that is exactly how I've seen it work. So here's where I have found this. Here's where it's landed for me. This is what I'm doing. And the reason that I'm not preaching and saying here's how it is because I believe that these are topics that we as astrologers, anybody prepared to flesh out new paradigms, should use their own intuition on. If anybody is out there, and it does not mean that any astrology that, an astrology reading that anybody's had last week is somehow invalid. It doesn't mean that astrology paradigms we've been using are invalid. This is about bridging into new information and applying it as our intuition proves and what we find successful. So a different person, a different astrologer could not entertain these topics I have going to introduce today at all and still be a perfectly valid astrologer. So, for me, here's what I see with Pluto. And I have a Pluto-Sun conjunction, so I have a particularly intimate relationship with Pluto. Pluto, to me, is the great boogeyman that we create from our fears. And Pluto is a water sign, or Pluto rules Scorpio, of course, and we've always recognized Scorpio as being this sign of transformation, death and rebirth, sexuality, great, other people's money, but really the other thing about Scorpio for me in the eighth house and this area defined by Pluto is that it's the place where we want to transmute. We wish to have it burn down to the core, kind of like the Tower card in Tarot is how I always have seen that. So Pluto is, in my experience, is this combination of both the great evils that we can, we know what it is to be afraid of something and have that fear. Whatever we're afraid of starts to take on bigger and bigger and more boogeyman qualities, right? It becomes demonic. And what that is, when we finally have to face certain fears and to walk through them and how we are transmuted in the process, when you realize your fear is, that the fear of what you fear is far greater than the actual experience. But it is very cauterizing to us as human beings to go through that. And in my experience with that, and those with real Pluto sensitivity, my experience has been, it's really until those natives face their fears either by walking into them and embracing them, or the other powerful way that Pluto does this is your worst fears come true. Either way, you have to experience them. Until that happens, if you've got really strong Pluto placement in your chart, I find that you're basically afraid to be yourself. You're afraid of your own natural process. And then once that's happened, other fears can come up, but you can never make the lie the truth again. So we kind of know in our soul after that. Other fears may happen. They may look large and ominous. And the image that I've always had for this is the Wizard of Oz, right? There's the great and powerful Wizard of Oz on the screen versus, the guy behind the counter, behind the wall there doing the things. And that's the trick to this. These are not illusionary fears at all. These are real dynamics, and we are afraid of them, but our fear begins to make them mythological. So collectively, I thought, to some extent, we certainly played that out with World War II. But I think an even better example of that would be what happened with us in the United States during the Cold War. Huge mythological evil Soviet Union, and specifically if you're going through the transformation of Pluto. And I'm not faulting anything any of us did, and I'm not saying that, you know, Hitler was a great guy. I'm not saying any of that. The key to it, however, is when we see our fears in their mythologically, you know, if we have fears that are sensitive to Pluto and they become mythological, we then will start to bring forward defenses and energy commensurate with the size of the mythological evil that we think we're seeing. So this becomes a great personal power suck for if you engage this for too long. And I think we know what that is. When all of a sudden our lives, as it was, for instance, with the United States, we spent tons of money and tons of energy and tons of focus on having to be prepared against this great mythological and evil Soviet Union, only to find out after the fact that, you know, we knew before that, but of course this story was being used to fund a lot of military projects on our side. More importantly, they'd been bankrupt for a while. There was no mythological evil that was about to come after us.
So I think it's funny that it's trying to be recreated right now. You know, you see it again.
I think it's recreated all the time, right? I mean, this is a great human dynamic in my experience. And I think that is what Pluto is here. That's why it changed in 2006, right? We, our consciousness started to, I believe, became red, because really, sadly, between 2003 and 2006, I think it was about 3 years into the Iraq War before any journalist ever had the balls to start to question whether there was WMDs. Now, yeah, I don't care who those journalists are. We were there in 2003 staring at the screen, you and I, going, are you kidding me? And there wasn't a journalist for across the United States that did anything other than wave flags at that. So
right.
There, the whole, you know, that whole process was just, you know, hook, line, and sinker on this mythological evil that we'd been told existed, which then warranted this huge military expense and action and death and everything else. So it was interesting to me that it's 2006 that Pluto shows up, or our consciousness shows up and says, wait a minute, I wonder what this isn't as big as we said it was. And yet I think it's become even more powerful. I think that Pluto, and also the idea that these relationships to our fears, that in fact if we will allow this to be a relationship, then it won't be such a big boogeyman. You know, you don't have to embrace all your, you know, for instance, the no pain, no gain spiritual path was was also starting to plague us after 2006, including, you know, the guy in Sedona, right, who put those people in the sweat lodge and basically told them that they had to stay, right, when they were needing to get out because what he was telling them. Oh, that's just your ego fighting back. You need to purify and, you know, right? How many of us have heard that story? How many of us have fallen for that story? And therefore they died. Well, that to me was the end of that story, that this is a nurtured relationship that we want to have with our soul, with our fears, and with this level of transformation. Very much like, you know, making all the small physical changes we need to as we go, and then we don't end up presumably with a massive pile of physical illnesses that we have to overcome eventually. So there's physical analogies for this as well. So Pluto to me represents this our collective's relationship to how much of our creative power as human beings are we going to be willing to devote in our personal lives and collectively to great mythological evils that are really just the face of our own fears. Most importantly, how long do we want to be susceptible to being manipulated as a result of that? Because this is a place of tremendous manipulation collectively.
Yeah, you know, I find this interesting because I think in 2006 it would have been, Pluto would have been moving through the last degrees of Sagittarius on its way to Capricorn. And, of course, now we have Saturn, even though it is backtracking a little bit into Scorpio for a short time, it will be moving through the sign of Sagittarius over the next couple of years. And truly, when that happens, we end up with a new possibility in terms of truth, You know, what is the truth? Are these mythological fears and evils really the truth? Do we want to keep recreating the same demon, the same concept of dark versus light and all of these kinds of dualities that we have going on? Or do we choose to be free of that and go on to a different direction? I think that's potential, the high side for all of this. Is that something you would see in this as well?
Well, I do, but I look as well. The thing that I keep coming back to with Pluto, though, and that's why I keep seeing that image of the Wizard of Oz, is not that our mythological fears have no substance. They do have substance.
Yes.
It's not that there aren't things in the world that maybe are wrong and we need to address them. And it's not that we aren't, you know, that there isn't something real inside of our own personal fears, right? I mean, that's, you know, like anybody who is, you know, violently treated by, you know, in some horrible way when they're a child, the perpetrator remains mythologically large, whether that was a bully or a teacher or a parent or whomever. It doesn't mean that some injury didn't happen. It doesn't mean
right.
that everything was really good and you just need to get over it. But we also know, and not in every case does that need to be confronted. That's true. But there are those, that specific transformation we go through when we confront those, some of those fears. And we don't usually have to confront them all. Once we've faced one, we know the difference. We know what it is to face down our own mythological fear and look at the actual pain and the actual evil, if you will, for what it is. See it in its actual size.
Mm-hmm.
That transmutes the soul. And it's interesting to me that I still, you know, as it in that progression, if you go through starting with Aries and you progress through the entire zodiac, Scorpio, and even what we're talking about with Ephesus, Scorpio is the place between Libra and Sagittarius. So this is the transformation our soul has to finalize to move out of the interpersonal and into the transpersonal aspects of life. For us to truly know the truth, it can't be imbued, you know, with these. We can't carry forward these mythological fears as if they're real.
Right, right. Interesting thing.
So
now,
I think it's a great. Go ahead.
I was going to say now take
Sorry.
This into somebody's chart. If you were to look at this in a chart, are you looking at Pluto then as in terms of their mythic demons that they're creating or that they're struggling with in this lifetime?
I think Pluto represents the place in the chart that you a client is going to be challenged to
mm-hmm.
go through this transformation. This is not something we create. These mythological fears happen so deeply in our subconscious. It's already, right, we recognize Pluto as being the realm of the subconscious anyway. So it's
right.
not like a person can create these things. We are not really, I haven't found that we're all that, you know, that we should claim that we're empowered in the face of them. That's why they transmute us, because they're genuinely scary to just walk into that fear. But it's where I find a client to be sensitive. So during transits, whatever it's connected to, that's the place that that client is sensitive to the transfer, is going to find themselves experiencing that transformation. And until that part of their chart, aspect of their chart, whatever, wherever it lays, until we have faced fears regarding wherever that placement is, we will not be at peace. We will have to avoid that part of ourselves. But the other key to it is Pluto being a generational sign. So
right.
we
yeah.
have a
There's
whole
that.
Generation. That's the other dynamic I see more, is each of these generations, like right now, our generation is the Pluto in Pluto in Virgo generation. And
mm-hmm.
you'll see what we're doing with that power of Virgo with integration. The ability to just vet out the most powerful solutions, but they're not attention-getting solutions. We're the researcher analysts behind the scenes just figuring out the solution. You know, yes, you all can cry, you know. And at the same time, I think ecologically and from the Earth standpoint, that sensitivity to Earth that Virgo has, I think we're starting to, I think we're going to step forward and talk about where we're harming the environment because we keep projecting all of the our fears about our evils onto it. So in either direction, right? We have to both care for the, for instance, an example being, and everybody's, this is a huge generation and everybody has their role to play, but one of the things that I have been sensitive to is just how bad, how much of our sense of abundance on the planet is being diminished because of waste. So mm-hmm. not because we can't feed all the people on the planet, because we waste so much of the resources. And the fear of lack produces waste. So if we, the more we focus on the fact, the more the narrative is talking over and over and over again about how it's all awful and we're not going to have enough, the greater I see our capacity, our tendency to waste the resources we have. So that's an example of where I see Pluto in Virgo playing out in my chart, trying to calm down. When I hear, I'm highly sensitive to any time I think people see a mythological evil overtaking the planet. That's where I feel like I'm playing my role to say, wait a minute, hang on, because what we're triggering is our internal tendencies to waste our own resources as a result.
Yeah.
So
Interesting topic. I want to just take a quick break here and let people know who may just be tuning in that today our topic is new paradigms in astrology, and my guest is Bryn Morgan. And we've been talking so far about Pluto and its moon Charon, and how I don't know how to say these mythological names, but talking about the mythological fears that we're developing at times with Pluto. Bryn, I want to go on because we're already at close to an hour into the show here.
I know.
Amazing how time flies. I want to go on to the next topic that you're studying or looking at in terms of change. Have you said enough about Pluto and Charon at this time that we can
Absolutely.
Go into something?
I think we've done Pluto. Go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, because, you know, we already brought up the idea of Virgo and, mm-hmm. you know, what Pluto and Virgo as a generation is dealing with. Now, you're also working on a new understanding of Virgo and Libra in the charts. Do you want to launch us into that piece?
Yes, I will. And it's the one thing that I'm working on that I cannot tie to any change of our understanding of the solar system. However, in my work as an astrologer, I have not been satisfied on any level or increasingly with our understandings of Virgo and Libra. And that's been going on for years. And it really started with the fact that we were still left fundamentally without planets to rule them. So I'm going to say arbitrarily, we have used Mercury to rule Virgo and Venus to rule Libra. And I absolutely cannot make that work. I can never make that work. Fundamentally, you know, Virgo is an earth sign. And even though Virgo is very often understood to be a very mental sign, and you certainly see Virgos and where there's Virgo, and you're aware of a heavy analysis going on, so it seems very mental, it is still an earth sign. It is not an air sign. And
right.
Mercury, in my experience, and Gemini are a natural fit, but they absolutely are I find them to be an aberration if you try and apply it to Virgo, similarly with Libra. Interestingly, Libra is an air sign, and we talk quite often about, oh, the indecisive Libra, and they're peacemakers, and they're relationship-oriented, and I found that that was a great discredit to Libra as well. And if I, you know, Venus is a beautiful sign, but, it, you know, in my mind, if we had to stick them somewhere, I probably would have given Venus to Virgo and Mercury to Libra. To me, they're at least, you know, better, you know, Virgo being the vestal virgin. Yeah, I mean, I it would have been at least a little easier, but fundamentally, I don't use rulers for either one of them. So what did I find about, they represent some very powerful things, including they are the transition across the descendant in the chart, right? They are the transition from sixth to seventh house. And the other thing that's very interesting, so they represent something really fundamental about the interpersonal levels of astrology. And it's been my experience that the personal planets, the personal signs, the first four signs of the zodiac, I find that we understand very well, and the planets that represent them, I think, are natural fits. I find the same with the transpersonal signs and planets. Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces all have perfectly comfortable natural planetary rulers, and in my experience of them, I find that body is holding up extremely well. I don't think it needs to be advanced. In the interpersonal signs, that's where I find astrology breaking down in my work. Our understanding of the interpersonal, I think, is what we lack and what is actually changing. And I think that's, I'm bringing that up, and I'm not going to drag that out too much, but it's just like us as humans to assume that if we're missing something, we need to go further, reach further out. It's the bigger, bigger, bigger picture that we're missing. I don't think it is. I think it's the interpersonal picture that we don't understand. And so, or is going through a fundamental change. And right in the center of that, now, this is not how I started to look at Virgo and Libra, but it is interesting to me that right in the center of that is the shift from Virgo to Libra. And at the center of that, at 1 degree or 0 degrees of Libra, is the center of the Virgo supercluster. So we have the center of the galaxy, the Milky Way, at 26 right. degrees Sagittarius. But our galaxy is one of millions of galaxies orbiting a supercluster. They call it the Virgo supercluster. So our galaxy is orbiting with a whole bunch of other galaxies, a whole other cycle, and the center of that, the center of the universe for us, is actually 0 degrees of Libra. So we may not get to a lot of deep sky phenomena. I haven't done a lot of work on it, but there is the actual unity consciousness, I think, happens at 0 degrees of Libra. I think it's at that the center of the Virgo supercluster. Mm-hmm. And it is unity consciousness as in the, you know, hearing the voice of the great song of the universe, where, you know, it's not that we're all merged, it's where it is all just one big song feeling. And I think that's what Virgo represents. And I think the Virgo Libra represents. So for me, Virgo represents organic perfection. It is where we are honing and becoming efficient with our use in the material plane. And, of course, it's the polarity to Pisces. So where we have application, where we have practical application, where we have tested and, you know, vetted, and those are the terms I think are better, more appropriate for Virgo, is physical vetting. We're looking for practical applications, and we're looking to you know, create foundations that will last through our lives, because we've attended and continue to attend to the minutiae, we might think of. And, you know, that house that it rules being the house of health, but they're also the great house of healers. And this is the kind of healing more and more that is what we have healed is something we can heal others in, rather than being a trained healer in some skill. And then as we transition over a path of, in my mind, a point where we can hear the great song of the universe, we come into Libra, which I think is about harmonics, about the balance of the bihemispheral brain and what we can create by living in a world with duality. So if we've purified our motives and gotten clear and started to run and, you know, tuned our bodies in Virgo, in Libra, we start to create harmonics. So the idea of balance and the idea of harmony that we often associate with Libra, even relationships, remember Libra's an air sign. Relationships for Libra are not a, you know, warm and fuzzy sign. They're not a get married sign necessarily. They are an air sign. This is the mental power of the mental process. But what I think it's about creating, I think it's about harmonics. In other words, if I've tuned myself up in Virgo and you're tuned up in Virgo, when we get to Libra, you and I are in tune and we are now creating a harmonic between us. And therefore we have access to a full third, we have access to something that is greater than the sum of our two parts. And in that way, it represents relationship in the same, like the alchemical marriage, like Isis, Osiris, and Horus. So the chemical marriage that you have where you're creating from a harmonic, creating from those, from our work within duality, and it's where Libra understands the value of duality. And why it's here. We live in a dualized world for a reason. It is the fundamental, those are the building blocks of the creative tools, our tools for creation. But currently, I think we have a huge experience. If someone doesn't agree with me, I assume we're in conflict. We may not be in conflict, but we're also not comfortable or training ourselves to leverage what we disagree or what we see differently into a creative process. We're emotionally, I think, quite often, and I'm talking very generalistically here, emotionally it's very uncomfortable. We're not really prepared to take responsibility for our own process and our own desire to create, and that this is a creation. So we go into Libra, and that's not intact, and we often then just have to shy away or try and, be peacemakers. I just don't want conflict. I don't think that's what Libra is. I don't think it's a conflict-averse sign. I think it is a creatively, it wants conflict to become creativity. It wants it to become harmonics. And when that doesn't happen, it feels that, the energy is being wasted. So I think those two signs are up for, I don't know what we'll eventually find for rulership of them. I really don't. I have nothing.
Yeah, so at this point, you just don't even use a ruler, you said, for those two signs.
Nope. I used to use Chiron for Virgo, but it didn't fit that often. So I just don't.
Yeah, I wondered about whether maybe Chiron might.
Yeah, I'd heard that. I mean, Barbara Hand Cloud, postulated that back in the mid-80s when she was doing work on Chiron, but I don't know if she's. It has a lot in common with it. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it's a powerful image, but in general, I think it may have set us up for our view of ourselves and our relationship to the earth, where we're struggling to see everything. Wherever we are right now is perfect. We have to stop valuing our. How do I want to put that? There's a tendency we have to assume that if something is out of balance, therefore we had to have been wrong. We can't classify out of balance any more than we can classify illness as no longer being healthy. That's not true. If your arm is broken and when your husband had that tragic accident, his knee is crushed and it swells all up, and it is true to say that he needed medical attention. That's true, but in fact you're talking about a very healthy physical response. That response in his body came from health, not illness. Body rushed to the site and was doing, so yes, he's currently physically out of balance for a while and it's going to recover, but that's not the same as ill. So we have to stop, our body's responses to imbalance are not necessarily illness.
Out of balance.
Right. I mean, so we want to see it's kind of like the errors that can happen when people misapply the law of attraction. No, not everything that's ever happened to me that I responded negatively to is something I created. No. I mean, I'm living in a whole big, giant world with people who also have free will. I mean, I have the right to create a life that I find pleasant. But even having an emotionally unpleasant reaction to something or being harmed by something, it can be very informative. It may be a very important message, but it is not fundamentally a creation as in, oh, why have I brought this on myself? And I know you and I have heard that conversation, right? So to me, that's a misapplication of the law of attraction. And that's the kind of thing I see happening when people are not in balance with Virgo or not being brought up into what Virgo is. It is not honing in on all the flaws because it sees flaws everywhere. It's trying to keep everything. It's trying to be very tidy and attend to any minor imbalance as it comes up.
That's a great way of describing it. I like that description. You know, we're getting lower on time here. We have about 25 minutes left, and I know we have at least one caller that has some questions. Are you ready to do a reading?
Absolutely. And then if we have a little time at the end, maybe we could talk about the constellations.
Because that's exactly,
you know, we weren't
going to
read that way, but perfect. Okay.
Let's
do a reading.
Okay, so I'm going to bring in Londa. And hello, Londa.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me?
Hello. Yes.
Yes, I can. I'm going to be quiet because she's sitting in my room here with me.
Okay. So, hello, Bren. This has been a really interesting talk this afternoon, and I really appreciate you being on the show and taking my call and doing a reading and assisting us today. So just to give you a little background, I'm an energy science practitioner, and I, you know, have clients and work with clients. I also have been working with the Akashic Records. I just came back from a whole month of spiritual boot camp in Bali and stuff. So, you know, when you're with 60 other practitioners and healers and you know, consciousness people that are raising their consciousness, you know, lots of things come up. So it was a very interesting time. And so anyway, so I'm just, you know, it's just, I would like to see where you can see in my chart where things might be leading me on my path at this time.
Sure, yeah. Now, Londa, was there anything, I can just look at you in general, or was there anything we've discussed so far that had your attention and you'd like me to focus on as far as these new topics? Because we don't have to stay on those topics, but I just was curious.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like, me, I'm more honing in on my mastery, but in doing that, I have noticed and become very aware of different things that are coming up, you know, aspects of me that have just been really coming to more to light, and then to move through that to find the divine truth in things, you know, and coming from that awareness, that higher awareness, moving out of the lower ego, the lower consciousness, and, you know, it's been a little bit of a struggle here lately. And then all of a sudden you get the aha and the self-realizations and realizing those aren't your truths and those aren't your truths anymore, and moving through that. And then getting finally to the access to those divine truths, and it's been an amazing journey here lately. And so as you were talking about the wars and everything that was going on and what created that, it's like, how can, you know, how are more people coming to that realization? Where are we coming as humanity? Are we moving through things and that as well as, you know, my chart too? I mean, that's a big loaded question. I get that. But.
No. I mean, I I'm going to actually, Janet, if you're still listening, can you confirm, when I was pulling up Londa's chart, my the time zone gave me some really weird time zone, and I want to confirm the rising sign that you have, because I'm looking at these in a house specific way, and I want to make sure I'm accurate. So, Janet, can you tell me if you also see a 10 degree Leo rising?
Yes, I do.
I do.
Okay, so we have a 12th house sun, right?
Correct.
Right
on the
edge. Okay. That's it. Okay, so Londa, everything I see in your chart means that as consciousness goes, so go you. And you have so much Piscean resonance in your chart. Now, we should tell, obviously you know, or the audience should know, you're a Leo. So Leos are designed, of course, to, you know, we think of Leos as needing center stage and wanting attention, but I think we're viewing this from too low a vibration. The sun represents Leo, and the sun actually doesn't send any energy to Earth at all. We live off of the byproduct of what the sun does with its energy. Gravitational pull takes all of this energy of the sun and pulls it into the center with such force that atoms are fused, and out of the byproduct of that is the energy we live on. So at the core, Leo is trying to pull. You at your core are here to pull all of your juice inward into a huge creative explosion. You are here to become a shining light, but not because you're focusing on others. You're focusing on your own inner creative fire. It also suggests in your chart, because I'm gonna link back into your question in a minute, but it also suggests in the chart that there is something called the south node and north node of the moon, and the south node is what we've mastered in past lifetimes. And the north node is the exact opposite point. So in our lives, we come in and we're designed to reacquire that great mastery. So we're supposed to sort of live out of the modality of that south node. And then at some point, that stagnates. It just you can't do it anymore. And it's because you mastered it, not because it's a bad idea. So you have to go to the opposite point. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, your opposite point is Leo, also, and it's very close to Uranus, and it's in your first house, which says that the last thing on the earth you wanted to do when you got here was think about yourself. And on some level, you probably have experienced necessarily, very much on purpose, a kind of aversion. It's not about Londa. And yet in your soul, you know that that's the only, you know, it's, I don't know what it would look like, but it, you know, it could look like almost a secret longing, or at minimum, there's this desperate, that's the wrong way to say it, but you have so much, everything outside of that is incredibly Piscean. It is about the collective, super sensitivity to the supersensible realms. You are here as a compassionate soul, and this role you're playing is out of love and compassion for humanity, collectively. So if humanity is suffering, and you're tuned into that, it is both destabilizing to you personally, and it could also be overwhelming, but you're sensitive to that because that's why you're here. So you're somehow learning to focus on you and let this true creative explosion come about inside of you, presumably as, you know, and I think it's quite often true, right? Those of us who have been here working on changing consciousness used to naturally be very focused on how we could affect and help other people bring about their changes. But now there's a great move towards you got to be it. You know, if you exist as the solution, other people can see that a solution exists, but you won't necessarily be able to control or affect their choice about whether they choose the solution or not. So in your chart as well, I don't know how much of your chart you know, you have, of course, your moon is in Pisces, and Pisces, that moon is at 15 degrees. So Chiron itself has just been finishing up, passing over your moon over and over again. So your emotional, to do things because you need to be emotionally fed, Pisces, but you also have a Chiron in Pisces. So you were setting up a wound where you were becoming a psychic sponge. So I would imagine there's been a long process of both being very sensitive to and aware of the great compassion that you have for other people, and you're here because you don't want, you know, I don't know how this would have formed in your consciousness, but you certainly are sensitive to the fact that other people are suffering. Sometimes you could have been to the point where you were being overwhelmed. Interestingly, however, so that Chiron wound, and there's a lot of us born in 1961. We all have this Pluto in Virgo. It's all, we all have Chiron opposite Pluto in Virgo. My experience of this is that we're here to finish up and embody the highest to retain and embody the highest levels of the Christos energy while also becoming very sensitive healers on sort of the dregs of the age of Pisces, where martyrdom is no longer serving us, where too much collective sensitivity is not, in fact, you know, the most powerful thing anymore. This is not saying it wasn't powerful, but there are a lot of dregs, I think, of dregs of the age of Pisces that need to be sort of, okay, this is the chaff, right? We know what the wheat is. It's time to start sweeping away the chaff. Fine, right? That's not of any use any longer. It's been used up. Time to eliminate the waste.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I see in your chart is this is a great, it's like you're weaving a big tapestry, but the big two colors are this need to let the creative fire explode inside of you. Focus inwardly, which is something you would have been very resistant to, while also learning and embodying a vision that being a solution is actually mm-hmm. the highest calling right now, rather than offering a solution. So
mm-hmm.
be healed, and then other people can choose by interacting
mm-hmm.
with you to choose healing for themselves, or choose peace for themselves, or choose. But we are not. You're not going to be in a position to affect it in them in a way that you used to. Most of
mm-hmm.
us, many of us with Chiron and Pisces, or you may have come up in the kind of schools I did where you could literally take on the emotional wounds of others and purify it through your own emotional body, and then they'd be healed, like, you know, sin eaters. So that
mm-hmm.
that kind of process of literally ingesting other people's, you know, wounds so that they
mm-hmm.
can move forward, because we're in a position to run it and purify it, you know, those kinds of patterns I see quite often with people with Chiron and Pisces. Those that probably have already ended for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so the one place in your chart that I think you would be most sensitive to the Pluto, and the thing I want to mention to you is the great Wizard of Oz for you probably happens around materialism and abundance.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow I would want to guide you, if it's ever shown up where you're realizing you're not allowed to live in an abundant state for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Other people are something, the bodhisattva, whatever. I mean, if somehow there's some part of the great fear that if you take what you really want, you'll be taking from others. I don't know. But that,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I'm not trying to delve too far, but I would say the great place that you're facing your own fears has to do with you being fully, abundantly, materially supported.
Okay, that's right on. Mm-hmm.
Now Jupiter, I mean, maybe, you know, I know you know Janet, so you may already know this. Jupiter came, you know, last summer. Jupiter was passing. Jupiter is a very expansive planet, so Jupiter passed over your sun. It came across your rising sign. It's coming through your first house. By next month, Jupiter is going to be hitting that north node and Uranus in the first house. So this is the time. I would imagine if it feels resonant for you, it's because you're being given a tremendous boost of, it's okay, it's time now. You know,
yeah.
Presumably maybe in that retreat you were in, you're starting to presumably see how things that felt that they were polarized inside of you. God, if I'm this, I can't be that. If I'm that, I can't have this. You're probably
mm-hmm.
really now starting to feel either peace, they can coexist, I see solutions, there's ways I could do
right.
this I never thought about. Because you're trying to pull together two things that don't want to naturally resonate together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you are here to you know, the classic term for North Node and Leo is you're here to gain an ego. You're developing
oh.
an ego. You're coming out of an egoless state. And so
mm-hmm.
why do you want an ego? What does that do? And, you know, ego, I know I hate using, to me the term ego represents, I would say, personality, right? The part
mm-hmm.
of our structure that's sensitive to keeping us healthy and alive. It's also the part of us that refracts light. So it's the piece that other people can see. So to shine up as a, you know, if you want to show up as a powerful solution, you want to radiate brightly and you want people to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Get noticed.
Yes. And it's probably uncomfortable. right? So,
right.
But you know that, but it's also the channel that wants to open up is a powerful channel with Uranus, which is literally, you know, the voice of wisdom and higher self.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you're merging with your higher self as you do it.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, thank you so much, Brynn. That was great.
Yeah, that's
thank you, Londa.
Thank you.
All right, so Brynn, we have about 10 minutes left, and as you were talking to Londa, I was looking down at one of the pages that you had sent me in this document that you have written, where you are kind of outlining what one of the new paradigms might be, which is this change possibly with the addition of a 13th sign, and how that you know skews the zodiac somewhat. And in that case, then Londa becomes a Cancer.
Ah, well, let me say that what happened was that what we have was established 2,000 years ago. We created very evenly spaced 30-degree components of the sky. We named them for the major constellation that was in them. And I still use that zodiac. It is a location device. It's designed to allow us to identify what location something, a star or something, is at. And I still use it. What they did in 1930, interestingly, was officially define and chart the 88 constellations in the heavens. And the constellations themselves are not evenly spaced at 30 degrees apart ever, right? So, and because the ecliptic and the precession of the equinoxes and the elliptical plane, where all the planets are orbiting on a very similar plane to one another around the sun, the zodiac is a fairly narrow band of about 8 degrees high or low of the horizon. And we now had clear, we had officially defined where the actual constellations were, and because of the shift, this new constellation of Theseus shows up on the zodiac. So really the change is that we're defining constellations, and they've in many cases shifted a ways away from...
Oh no, we've lost Brynn. So we'll wait for a few moments while she's calling back in. But essentially what she's saying is that over the course of time, the zodiac has precessed, but our understanding of the zodiac hasn't changed any. And at this point in time, then, for example, as we look at some of these different signs, the dates that they hold that space are no longer valid. And because the different constellations take up different degrees of the sign and not just 30 degrees like we've assigned it, then maybe that we have to have a different understanding, or it's possible to have a different understanding of what's gone on. Brynn, are you back with us? Hello, Brynn?
Hello?
Brynn, there you are.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yay!
You drew...
Okay, I heard you eloquently going on without me, which is fine. So,
I wasn't sure if you were going to be able to get back in, but, you know, maybe, you know, if I missed anything or maybe clarify anything that I might have misstated, but essentially it's the potential that we have of a new definition of some of these signs.
It is, so really the question is it the constellation which sets up the energy that we recognize as those signs, or is it the area of the sky we had previously identified? And that's an interesting question. Most constellations don't exist. They have absolutely no relationship to one another. Pleiades is one of the rare ones, but they are a two-dimensional view of stars that may be hundreds of thousands of light years apart. So they aren't actually tightly, almost none of these constellations are actually having any, the stars in them don't actually have any relationship to one another. So are they, they are pretty pictures, but when we looked at the quadrant of the sky that was Scorpio or was, we had called Aquarius, I don't know, is it the quadrant or was it the constellation?
Yeah.
And I don't have an answer. I am still using the quadrant. I still rely on a 360-degree zodiac, evenly spaced at 30 degrees and named for what they had been named for, because I still find it to be effective. But it is one of the great questions, and maybe somebody else's intuition goes a whole other direction on this and starts reading it for the constellations. If you want to follow the constellations, then you have to start adjusting where you're right. You have to start adjusting it. And Londa is a Cancer.
Yeah.
Are you a different sign?
Yeah, I actually, my birthday's next week. I turn out to be a Taurus as opposed to a Gemini, which I don't even know what to think about that.
And I'm a Leo, which...
Which, oddly enough, Bryn, for the length of time I've known you, I have a tough time believing that you are a Virgo. I always want to see you as a Leo.
I know.
Oh, yes, she's a Leo. But you're not a Leo. You're a Virgo. And that it's just sort of interesting. It's very interesting.
This
whole topic is like food for thought. I mean, it gets me going. There's a lot of people, actually, astrologers out there who get... you know, a lot of grief from other astrologers, but they are sort of looking at this model and this paradigm and looking at it and saying, okay, maybe we need to be more precise in the way we're looking at these signs and see if that has any effect on, you know, people's personalities and so forth. But of course, you have to test it. You have to test it, as you've said.
Yeah.
You know, you have to test these new paradigms with people before you have any inkling if it works. Or if it, you know.
That's right.
Sense.
And that's why I'm not interested much these days in people who tell me what the new paradigm is. I don't think we have the new paradigm. What we have are hypotheses, hopefully, and those of us who have them and are interested in them can start to vet them. And that's exactly right. But just like human design, which is another really advanced and very new, fresh paradigm with which to help guide clients. As long as we can start to, I mean, I think it's obvious astrology has to start to shift. I think everybody, I would think, most people are aware this is starting to lag behind consciousness. It doesn't actually matter what new paradigms we come up with and how we work with them. As long as we at least start to refresh and move forward, consciousness is moving, therefore these tools have to move. And I think that's, I think that's a given. I do.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
Bryn, thank you so much. I'm so sorry
but,
to interrupt you, but we are so close to running out of time here, and I want to give an opportunity for you to share with the audience how they can reach you, because I'm sure people listening have questions, and how can they reach you? How can they find out more about you? What's your website, et cetera?
Absolutely. I can be reached at www.awakenedoracle.com, AwakenedOracle.com. And I'm Bryn, Bryn, at AwakenedOracle.com. Or you can contact me by phone at 760-717-4904. Thanks very much.
Yes, and... Bryn, you're currently working on putting this information together, hopefully in a book that may come out sometime in the next future.
Yes, absolutely. That is what this is being developed into a book. So presumably in the next 2 months, that'll be available. And
nice.
I'll be back to announce it.
I know, exactly. We'll have her back on here. And we may just have to have you back on to talk more about this particular subject that we really didn't get to get into, which is, you know, the realignment perhaps of the universe or our zodiac. And also I want to talk more sometime about deep sky phenomenon, which is where you get more into the galactic center and the supercluster or the Virgo supercluster and so forth. So we'll definitely have you back on. Thank you so much for joining us today, and please reach out to Bryn if you have questions about some of the topics that we've brought up today. Next week, we'll be talking about the summer solstice and how the planets are aligning for the next 3 months. So join us at 4 p.m. Pacific time next Thursday, June 18th. Thank you so much for being here today, and everybody have a stellar week. Thank you for joining us today on Living Astrology. You can reach Janet for readings or astrological advice at www.living-astrology.com or by email at janet@living-astrology.com. Would you like to host your own weekly radio show? If so, contact us at empoweruradio@gmail.com. Or if you would like to be considered as a guest or would like to recommend a guest, email us at empoweruradio@gmail.com. Goodbye for now and have a stellar week.